about them, the scientists faced a very real and crucial hurdle. They had to learn to fly jets. Two of them, physician Joe Kerwin and astronomer Kurt Michel, were already qualified jet pilots. Physicist Owen Garriott had a private pilot's license, but the other three had never flown an airplane of any kind. These men, physician Dwayne Graveline, physicist Ed Gibson, Garriott, and Schmidt, headed to Williams Air Force Base in Arizona for a year of pilot training. Within 3 weeks, Graveline had left the astronaut program for personal reasons. The three who persevered at Williams, meanwhile, were soon immersed in learning to fly. After 30 hours of basic flying instruction in a Cessna 172, they moved on to jets. First, the modest T-37, then, at last, the sleek, high-performance T-38. Competing against younger cadets, they graduated in the upper third of their class, with Gibson and Garriott very near the top. But that hardly seemed to matter in the summer of 1966, as Schmidt, Gibson, and Garriott returned to the astronaut office with their wings, to the visible surprise of some of the pilots. In their absence, NASA had selected the original 19, who now joined the five scientists for classroom studies. When classes ended, the scientists lost all illusions of moving ahead. The 19 were assigned to support crews. The scientists, who ostensibly had more seniority, weren't. No one had to come out and tell them what was suddenly obvious. The pecking order didn't apply to them. They were never in line. At this low point, each of the scientists faced his own private decision. Each decided to tough it out. It was almost beyond belief to the pilots when NASA selected 11 more scientist astronauts in the summer of 1967. Still, they had a good idea what brought it on. They knew the tension between NASA and the scientific community had not abated. They probably did not know that at NASA headquarters, George Mueller had been pressuring Deke Slayton to get manned up for the Apollo applications' Earth orbit and lunar missions that would follow the Apollo landings. What Mueller didn't seem to recognize, or perhaps didn't want to believe, was that most of those missions were disappearing from the NASA budget, even as the new scientists were being screened. And on the day 11 bright-eyed young scientists reported to Houston for their first day as astronauts, they didn't get the welcome they expected. Shepard's politely worded greeting boiled down to this: "We can't use you, and if you had any brains, you'd leave." They didn't even get their own offices. They were corralled into one big area that became known as Boys Town. Once the shock wore off, the new scientists did their best to take their predicament in stride. They hung in through flight training, once more some graduating in the top of their classes and classroom instruction, and then went after whatever assignments were available. If they had to be the jetsam of the astronaut corps, they could at least do it with a sense of humor. They dubbed themselves the XS-11. It was clear from the beginning that none of the XS-11 had any hope of getting a seat on a moon flight. Even Apollo applications, whose raison d'etre was science, was a long shot, since Schmidt's group was ahead of them in line for those seats. As it would turn out, the XS-11 would have to wait until the 1980s to fly in space, by which time some of them would be in their 50s. By comparison, Schmidt's group had it good. And you would have not known Schmidt was an underdog if you had seen him in action around 1967. Slayton assigned him as the astronaut representative on the ALSEP experiments, and under his own initiative, he branched out to cover the lunar module's descent stage and its cargo of gear, geology tools, television cameras, other experiments, and these were just the beginning. His bachelor apartment, across from the manned spacecraft center, became a center for roundtable discussions on lunar exploration. One evening, Schmidt would host his geologist colleagues. The next, it would be an assemblage of top-level Apollo managers. Mission strategies and goals, rock-collecting techniques, new theories of the moon's geology, and other issues were under discussion. None of the other scientists matched Schmidt's involvement in Apollo. He was almost fanatical in his focus. If he had any life outside of Apollo, which some doubted, he never talked about it, geologist friends would call to invite him to dinner on a Saturday night to find out he was spending the weekend working. Even when they coaxed him out for a break, he talked shop. There was a bar at the Nassau Bay Hotel called the Seville Club, otherwise known as the Boom Boom Room for the loud bands that played there. For one brief moment in the 60s, the Boom Boom Room had topless waitresses. One afternoon, a few of the geologists dragged Schmidt there for a beer, and he spent the time in lively discourse on strategies for lunar exploration. If Dick Gordon, for example, had done that, they would have checked for a pulse. Schmidt also seemed oblivious to pressure. Aside from the scrutiny from other astronauts, there were those outside of NASA who watched him even more intently. Now that he was an astronaut, some scientists expected him to be the scientific community's inside man. But Schmidt knew his strength was that he could play both sides of the issue. To the scientific community, he was a friendly representative of the astronaut corps, and he worked hard to represent the astronauts' positions and to educate the scientists in the realities of spaceflight. And to the astronauts, he was a voice of encouragement to do more science, but without the unrealistic expectations that outside scientists often brought. And increasingly, Schmidt was doing what few of his colleagues on the outside could. He was spurring the pilots' interest in geology. That wasn't easy. Most of the pilots had little or no enthusiasm for geology classes, and with good reason. Schmidt saw the problem soon after he arrived. The astronauts were being lectured to, served up a hopelessly dull plate of chemical formulae and arcane schemes for classifying rocks, the kind of material that had almost put Schmidt to sleep when he was a Caltech freshman. And when it came right down to it, geology classes were just extra work for men who already had their hands full. Schmidt saw a chance to improve things with a training program that was tailored to the specific tasks of lunar exploration, but first he would have to get Al Shepard's approval. By the fall of 1967, he had it. A year later, Schmidt, like everyone at the Space Center, was caught up in the tremendous push to send Apollo 8 to the moon. Frank Borman had his hands full getting ready and asked Schmidt to put together a flight plan for the 20 hours in lunar orbit. From then on, Schmidt became Apollo 8's unofficial scientist astronaut. When Bill Anders wanted extra preparation for his role as the first geologic observer in lunar orbit, Schmidt was eager to give it. Borman never missed a chance to give Anders a jab about that, and at press conferences he would say, "Well, Bill Anders is the scientist, let him explain that." Borman didn't actually pronounce scientist as if it meant second-class citizen, but he didn't have to. By the time of Apollo 10, Schmidt understood that his efforts would go much farther if he could win the support of the mission commander. Thankfully, Tom Stafford was interested, and he brought his crew to several briefings with the geologists. Frank Borman's team had called the moon a black-and-white world, raising new questions about its true colors. Stafford was eager to settle the issue and to take whatever pictures and make whatever observations the geologists wanted as long as they didn't interfere with the mission. Not that Stafford was that interested in the moon. More than anything else, Schmidt realized, Stafford wanted his mission to stand out, and if he and his crew could settle a few lunar mysteries, it wouldn't hurt. Unfortunately, Stafford's crew didn't have much time for science. Of course, neither did Neil Armstrong's. Schmidt understood that on the first landing, science had to take a back seat, a fact that Shoemaker and some of his colleagues didn't seem to understand. They protested bitterly that Apollo 11's lunar module pilot wasn't a scientist. In his most naive moments, Schmidt could agree with them. If they were really smart, they'd put a geologist on the first landing, despite the fact that he had barely seen the inside of a simulator. Deke Slayton obviously didn't have any such delusions. He would say, "A dead scientist on the moon wouldn't do anybody any good. A scientist on a spaceflight had to be an astronaut first, and a scientist second," and in his more realistic moments, Schmidt had to agree. More importantly, some of the scientists had underestimated the astronauts. Neil Armstrong's work on Apollo 11 made that clear. For years, the geologists had the feeling that Armstrong was genuinely interested, and that he was picking up more than most of the other pilots. They were right. Armstrong turned in an excellent performance on the moon. In the post-flight debriefings, he was full of detailed comments on what he had seen, and he made clear the potential for a scientific observer on the moon. With that in mind, Schmidt and other geologists, including a friend from his days at Flagstaff, Gordon Swan, eagerly began training Pete Conrad and Alan Bean for Apollo 12. By the time they left Earth, Conrad and Bean were excellent geologic observers, but on the moon, To Schmidt's great surprise, they seemed to avoid talking about what they saw in detailed geologic terms. At one point, Conrad mentioned a rock that had a glint of green in it, the color of a ginger ale bottle. Schmidt realized immediately that Conrad was talking about the mineral olivine, and he knew Conrad knew it too. Schmidt was convinced that one reason for Conrad's reluctance had come from some of the geologists. They had been listening when Buzz Aldrin radioed a description of a sparkling rock at Tranquility Base, which he said looked like some sort of biotite. The mineral biotite is a form of mica, and mica can only form where there is water. The moon has no water, and hence no mica. Behind their closed office doors, these scientists complained, "Why try to teach them anything?" But these scientists missed the point. Aldrin didn't say it was biotite. He said it looked like biotite. He even hedged his bet by adding, "We'll leave that for later analysis." He was doing exactly as he'd been trained, describing what he saw as best he could. But these few scientists raised such an outcry that word got back to Conrad and Bean during training. After that episode, Schmidt could understand why Pete Conrad didn't want to risk making a dumb shit mistake on the moon, with the world listening. But for Pete Conrad, geology was not at the top of the list. Until July 1969, he was still preparing to fly the first landing in case Apollo 11 failed. Even afterward, he was absorbed in perfecting the pinpoint landing, visiting the surveyor, and so on. But that changed with Apollo 13. For the first time, the objective was geologic exploration. For Apollo 13, Schmidt redoubled his efforts. He knew what was needed more than anything was a professional teacher, someone who could relate to the pilots and inspire them, who could do what those dull classroom lectures could not. In the summer of 1969, Schmidt called on his friends at Harvard and Caltech for help. Gene Shoemaker suggested that Schmidt contact a man who had been one of Schmidt's professors. His name was Lee Silver. Leon T. Silver was a scientist of great standing, known not only as a skilled and thorough field geologist, but a superb geochemical analyst. He had made his career roaming the desert and mountain country of the southwestern United States and trying to decipher the earliest portion of the geologic record. This was the expanse of time geologists called the Precambrian, everything that happened prior to the explosion of multicellular life some 570 million years ago. The Precambrian is truly the terra incognita of geology. Reading the story in these rocks is difficult. Often they have been crushed or melted and reformed so that their original character is all but unrecognizable. Sometimes it is accomplishment enough simply to determine how old such rocks are. Geologists do that by reading one of several isotopic clocks contained in them, and in the late 1950s, Silver made some pivotal refinements to the method, specifically for measuring the decay of uranium into lead. That work won him high honors, including membership in the National Academy of Sciences. In the 1960s, Silver, with his grad student Mike Duke, turned his attention to a certain class of meteorites that they felt might very well resemble what astronauts would find on the moon. By the time the first lunar samples were on Earth, Silver, at age 44, was one of the scientists named to study them. Like Shoemaker, he was eager to see a trained geologic observer walk on the moon. Schmidt knew Silver well. At Caltech, Silver was known above all as a gifted teacher of field geology. It is hard physical work to go into the field, and after 10 or 15 years, most geologists hand over their classes to someone younger, but Silver never did. He was a vigorous intruder in the wilderness, his thinning golden-red hair concealed under a floppy hat, his sunburned nose protruding from a pair of sunglasses. It was his boundless energy and enthusiasm that made the difference to his students. After one lecture, they knew that they had encountered a man who would make an imprint on them. Schmidt was certain he could do the same for the astronauts. But would the astronauts give Silver a chance? Schmidt sought out Apollo 13's Fred Hayes, whom he knew to be one of the most enthusiastic geology students. With Hayes's help, Schmidt arranged a meeting between Hayes, Lovell, and Silver at a coffee shop in Cocoa Beach. Silver made a proposal. He would take Lovell and Hayes and their backups, John Young and Charlie Duke, to a place he'd picked for a trial run. "I'm personally convinced it's not going to be a waste of your time," he told Lovell and Hayes. "But you've got to convince yourselves. I'm willing to put the time in. Are you?" It was up to Lovell. Silver could tell that he was still skeptical. "We'll give you this one trip," Lovell said, "and if it works out, we'll see about doing it again." In late September, Silver loaded a party of seven, including Lovell and Hayes, Young and Duke, Schmidt and a field assistant, into one Caltech carryall and headed for Southern California's Orocopia Mountains. There was nothing official about it. They paid their expenses out of their own pockets and took the trip out of their vacation time. But in that place, a testing place for all of them, the astronauts entered a new realm as students with a master. The Orocopia Mountains rise up from the hottest desert in the country. They stand naked, devoid of vegetation, in unrelenting 100-degree heat. They are a geologist's paradise, brimming with textbook examples of geologic structures, variegated layers of rock in shades of red, yellow, orange, white, brown, are draped and folded, angled against one another, cut by faults, twisted by ancient spasms, now frozen in a time exposure of planetary history. Arriving in this geologic wonderland, Silver led the astronauts to a little half-valley that looked out on the bare hills. Silver turned and pointed to a gnarled ironwood tree a few yards away. "That tree is the LM," he said. "You've just landed. I want you to look out the window of the lunar module and describe what you see." One by one, Lovell, Hayes, Young, and Duke tried their hand. With rough verbal sketches, they rendered the lines of hills that stood before them. Silver listened. Then he coaxed them. "What about the layers in that mountainside? What about the texture of that rock? How would you describe that?" With impressive speed, the pilots caught on, and Silver pushed them to do even more. Soon they were proving to themselves the very thing Silver wanted most to teach them. Years of test flying had already given them the skills they needed to be excellent scientific observers. For 8 days, Silver led his new students through a kind of geology boot camp, up at dawn, out into the field after breakfast, working right up to dinner time. When nightfall came, Silver would lead them by flashlight back over the area they studied. They talked geology from the time they awoke until they went to bed. When the experiment was over, Lovell agreed that it had been a good experience and that they would schedule regular field trips. Young and Duke, who were looking forward to their own explorations on Apollo 16, were sold on the whole program. Silver had four astronauts hooked. Meanwhile, Lovell and Hayes emerged from the desert, grungy and unshaven, in time to attend the annual meeting of the Society of Experimental Test Pilots in Los Angeles. They walked into the lobby of the Beverly Hilton Hotel, looking like a couple of outlaws, and approached the desk, and as the clerk stared in surprise, Lovell said, "This is a stick-up." While Silver was working miracles in the California desert with commanders and lunar module pilots, other scientists fought their own battle for the command module pilots. The breakthrough came with Farouk Elbaz, a young, exuberant, Egyptian-born geologist with powers of persuasion. He worked for Bellcom, the Washington-based think tank hired by NASA headquarters as a kind of scientific tiger team that helped tackle anything from picking out landing sites to acting as a liaison with the scientific community. One of the first things Elbaz did after joining Bellcom in 1967 was to sift through all 4,322 pictures from the unmanned lunar orbiter probes and list every dome, crater, ridge, bump, and knob he could identify. From that exhaustive survey, which took 3 months, Elbaz formulated a list of 16 candidate sites, which together offered an example of every type of feature on the face of the moon. That effort turned Elbaz into a walking lunar databank. By 1970, Elbaz had already done some limited work with the lunar crews, including Tom Stafford's. But as for a real program of scientific observation, there was none. Mike Collins had little time to think about the moon when he was getting ready to go there. Dick Gordon didn't have much more. But for Apollo 13, with its emphasis on science, there seemed to be a new opportunity. Elbaz talked to Space Center geologist Mike McEwen, who told him he might be able to arrange a meeting with someone Elbaz had never met, Ken Mattingly. When Mattingly heard that a geologist named Farouk Elbaz wanted to talk to him about the moon, he thought it was a joke. Farouk Elbaz? Have we run out of geologists in this country? Face-to-face with Elbaz, Mattingly grudgingly agreed to a briefing at the Cape. Elbaz found the conference room ahead of time and covered the walls with spectacular lunar orbiter panoramas marked to show the orbital path of Apollo 13. When Mattingly arrived, with Lovell and Hayes, Elbaz got to the point. "Anyone can look," he told them, "but few really see. We don't know very much about the moon. You have a chance to help us know more." Then he took the men on a tour of the moon, reciting from his mental databank of landmarks and lunar mysteries, describing the lay of the land, and sneaking in a good bit of geology along the way. He could tell Lovell and Mattingly were still apprehensive, but Hayes was smiling with enthusiasm. Then they asked questions, and they listened to the answers. They began to make up nicknames for funny-looking craters they would use as landmarks. The meeting was supposed to go 2 hours. It went 5. When it ended, Lovell agreed to schedule repeats. In time, Elbaz was meeting with Mattingly regularly, preparing him for a solo mission of scientific observation. And so the command module pilots had their scientific mentor. Like Lee Silver, Elbaz had the infectious enthusiasm necessary to spark curiosity in the astronauts, and he had independently made the same discovery Silver had. Once the astronauts called science their mission, their competitive perfectionist energy did the rest. Sometime later, as Elbaz stood in the lobby of Building 4 at the Manned Spacecraft Center, a thin, red-headed man with a boyish face approached him. "Hey, you're Farouk Elbaz, aren't you? I'm Stu Roosa. I want you to make me smarter than Ken Mattingly." Had fate not intervened in the fortunes of Apollo 13's newly trained scientific observers, Lovell, Mattingly, and Hayes would probably have set a new standard for the astronauts who followed. The geologists sweated out Apollo 13's return along with everyone else, but when it was all over, they mourned the mission they had lost. Unfortunately, the prospects for Apollo 14 weren't so bright. Alan Shepard and Ed Mitchell were among the smartest men in the astronaut office. There was no doubt that if they had really wanted to, they could have met or even exceeded Lovell and Hayes' performance. But that wasn't what Shepard had in mind. One NASA geologist who was assigned to train Big Al was warned by his colleagues, "Don't be alarmed when he acts like this isn't very serious." During briefings, Shepard would tell jokes to whoever was sitting next to him, including his lunar module pilot. Whatever Mitchell's enthusiasm, it was apparently so dampened by Shepard's disinterest that another geologist later termed Apollo 14 the nadir of my efforts. Some believe that if Shepard and Mitchell had gone in more prepared, they would have found Cone Crater. Looking back, Schmidt would allow as how Shepard had other things on his mind, like getting up to speed after a 10-year absence from spaceflight and the fact that he was about to fly the first flight after a near disaster. Whether his attitude would have been any different under other circumstances, no one could say. In any case, the geologists learned a lesson with Apollo 14. The commander sets the tone. All this time, Jack Schmidt waged his own personal battle to win a seat on a lunar mission. Of course, as the only geologist, Schmidt knew he had an edge over the other scientists. If any of them were going to the moon, it would be himself, and his work with the lunar crews had won him greater standing in the astronaut office. Schmidt's biggest worry was that Shepard or Slayton might disqualify him on technical grounds. His edge as a geologist would mean nothing if he didn't measure up as an astronaut, and so Schmidt became a simulator hound. And when Fred Hayes needed a warm body to help with the crew compartment fit and function tests at Grumman, Schmidt was happy to volunteer again and again. By December 1969, he was feeling more confident that if he got the chance, he would not be found wanting. The newspapers were reporting that he would soon be named to a crew. Soon after the new year began, Shepard called Schmidt into his office and told him the same thing. He added that Schmidt should begin stealing simulator time, unaware that he had been doing that all along. By March 1970, it was official. Jack Schmidt was the backup lunar module pilot for Apollo 15. Now, working as an insider, Schmidt would help spark a competitive energy among the prime and backup teams of astronauts for the mission that would at last begin to realize Apollo's potential for scientific exploration. Chapter 10. A Fire to be Lighted. May 1970. On the highway that leads from Los Angeles to the Sonoran Desert, a mud-splattered truck, many field seasons beyond ever being clean again, sped east with Lee Silver at the wheel and a couple of rented four-wheel drive vehicles following behind. 2 hours from Pasadena, they pulled off the road into the Aracopia Mountains. Silver led his party on foot to a small valley strewn with cobbles and boulders. When winter rains were especially heavy, this dry wash became the mouth of a river several miles long and 100 yards wide. These rocks were the legacy of 100,000 rainy winters, rolled and nudged from the surrounding hills an inch or two at a time. "Get me the suite," Silver said quickly. "You've got 10 minutes. Silver watched as Dave Scott, Jim Irwin, Dick Gordon, and Jack Schmidt hunted among the boulders. The challenge for Silver's new students was to capture the variety of this place, from the typical to the exotic, in about a dozen hand-sized specimens. In geologic terms, such an assortment is called a suite of rocks. But in this case, Silver had asked the impossible. Dave Scott would always remember this as an exercise in frustration. There was too much variety here to be captured in just 12 samples, in just 10 minutes. But that was the point. It wouldn't be any easier on the moon. In the spring of 1970, Silver was determined that picking up a suite of rocks would become as second nature to these astronauts as flying the lunar module, and he had no doubts that with Dave Scott his efforts would pay great dividends. Even in a pack of overachievers like the Astronaut Corps, David Randolph Scott stood out. He seemed to have come straight from central casting, a six-footer with all-American good looks and built like a decathlon champion. In some circles, there was a joke that if NASA ever came out with an astronaut recruiting poster, Dave Scott should be on it. Born on Randolph Air Force Base, hence his middle name, Scott was a general's son who graduated near the top of his class at West Point, then became an Air Force fighter pilot. He projected an admirable combination of charm and enthusiasm. He was also an able salesman. Other astronauts knew Scott as serious and businesslike, and something of a straight arrow, but even those who didn't get along with him put him at the top. It was no accident that Scott was the first of the 14 to fly in space, but that experience, as co-pilot on Gemini 8's aborted tumble in Earth orbit, left him with an albatross around his neck. Scott had lost the chance to make a 2-hour spacewalk, and with it the chance to make his mark. Not until March 1969, when he turned in a flawless performance as Jim McDivitt's command module pilot on Apollo 9, did Scott feel he had shown the world what he could do. Early on, Scott had shown more enthusiasm for geology than most of the pilots. He'd long harbored an interest in archaeology. As a fighter pilot stationed in Tripoli, he'd visited the ruins of Roman cities in the Libyan desert. When the astronauts hiked into the Grand Canyon on one of their first field trips, Scott saw nearly 2 billion years of history written in twisted metamorphic rocks and perfectly exposed strata of limestone, sandstone, and shale. For the first time, he understood what it meant to talk about geologic time, in which millennia are reduced to moments, and each outing brought new spectaculars. When Scott fell in behind Pete Conrad for geology training on Apollo 12, he wasn't there just because it was part of the mission. At his home in Nassau Bay, Scott proudly displayed his rock collection in a specially made wooden cabinet, and when Jack Schmidt suggested that he consider a program of geology training with Lee Silver, Scott needed little convincing. He and Irwin met with Silver the day Apollo 13 was launched, and a month later, in May 1970, Silver returned to the Aracopias with his new students. Once again, it was a testing period for both sides, but when it was over, Scott gave his okay. For the first time, geology was fully integrated into the official training plan. By the time Lee Silver got to him, Scott was already poised to give his all for science. In the first days of training for Apollo 15, he told his crew, Command Module Pilot Al Warden and Lunar Module Pilot Jim Irwin, that their goal was to come back from the moon with the maximum amount of scientific data possible. More than any mission commander before him, Scott could afford to make that pledge. He'd come off Apollo 12 with the gut-level knowledge that he could land a lunar module. Even earlier, Apollo 9 had made him a rendezvous expert. He'd formed close working relationships with the flight controllers and knew what the conglomerate brain of mission control could do in a crisis. He didn't sweat free return trajectories or re-entry targeting. Like every Apollo commander, he wanted his mission to stand out, and he would do that with scientific achievement. But if Scott was a man who strove hard to make his mark, he was also ready to take Lee Silver as his mentor. Silver made him want to learn, to understand what the rocks could tell. He was hooked. Scott's backup, Dick Gordon, was equally enthusiastic, but not for the same reasons. He couldn't profess any innate love of geology, though he liked Lee Silver immensely. For Gordon, the only thing that mattered was crossing those last 69 miles, commanding his own crew, flying his own lunar module to a touchdown, and leaving his footprints in lunar dust. And if geology was part of that bargain, then that was fine with him. Gordon was happy to have Schmidt as his lunar module pilot, once he was sure Schmidt wouldn't get him killed. That worry faded quickly enough. Schmidt was by no means the best pilot Gordon had ever flown with, but he was certainly adequate. If Schmidt had trouble with anything, it was with the commander-subordinate relationship. That was something of an adjustment for the strong-willed geologist who tended to pursue his own ideas without submitting them to his commander. Gordon was ideally suited to the task of keeping Schmidt under control. And over time, the test pilot and the scientist became a team. Their rapport was real, in the air and at the field site. Gordon complimented Schmidt's exhaustive eye for detail with a talent for seeing the broad scope of things. If Jack Schmidt would reach the moon on Apollo 18, then he would have an excellent field partner. The geologists could hardly wait. Schmidt proved himself, too, in the simulator, not only as a systems man, but by learning to make a successful lunar landing. One day, the instructors decided to let him show it. During a descent, they failed Gordon's controls, but instead of letting Schmidt take over, Gordon waved his lunar module pilot aside and landed with his controls while Schmidt left. After more than 6 years, Dick Gordon wasn't about to let someone else land his spacecraft on the moon, even in the simulator. After the run was over, he emerged from the simulator and stormed past the instructor's consoles. "Tried to get me to let Jack land, didn't you?" He kept walking. "It didn't work, did it? It never will." And he was out of the room. The unpleasant possibility that had hung over Dick Gordon since he returned from Apollo 12 finally came to pass in the summer of 1970 when Apollo 18 was canceled. The news hit Gordon hard. He didn't say much, but when he did, once or twice, Lee Silver tried to commiserate. And being an optimist, he didn't stay down for long. As for Jack Schmidt, he seemed to be too absorbed in the training itself to be crestfallen. But then, if Schmidt felt disappointment, he wasn't the kind to show it. Gordon, Schmidt, and Command Module Pilot Vance Brand agreed that they would not give up without a fight. It was a long shot, but perhaps Slayton would assign them to Apollo 17. In the meantime, they would work to be the best crew around, so that Slayton's decision would be an easy one. At the same time, the cancellation reshaped the fortunes of Dave Scott and his crew. Until that time, Apollo 15 had been slated as the last of the so-called H missions, the limited exploration missions in which astronauts stayed no more than 33 hours on the moon, traveled on foot, and took two moonwalks. But NASA, anxious to increase the scientific yield of the final three landings, redesignated Apollo 15 as the first of the so-called J missions. In the works well before Apollo 11, the J missions were designed to push Apollo's capabilities to the limit. They would feature an upgraded lunar module, allowing three-day stays on the surface, and a long-duration backpack that would extend each moonwalk to as much as 7 hours. The J mission crews would explore places of greater geologic complexity. and they would make the most extensive lunar traverses yet, thanks to a battery-powered car called the Lunar Roving Vehicle, or as it was known, the Rover. Scott could not have been more delighted. It remained to choose a destination for Apollo 15, and in mid-September, the Site Selection Board convened in Houston. It had never been easy for the scientists to agree on landing sites, and this time was no exception. The various subcommittees and working groups had considered several alternatives and had narrowed the choices to two. One group favored Marius Hills, a collection of low, dome-shaped rises that scientists believed might be small, young volcanoes. The other choice, a place called Hadley, lay along the shore of Mare Imbrium, the Sea of Rains. Like most lunar maria, Imbrium's lava plains sit within a giant crater called an impact basin, ringed by mountains. Along Mare Imbrium's shore lies one of the moon's great ranges, called the Apennines, whose peaks tower as much as 3 miles above the mare. The geologists suspected that these mountains were blocks of a primordial crust that had been thrust upward by the tremendous force of the Imbrium impact. The chunks of basalt from Tranquility Base and the Ocean of Storms had taken geologists back to the era of mare volcanism. The Apennines promised to open a window on an even earlier time, perhaps all the way back to the moon's birth. Putting a lunar module down among the Apennines was out of the question, but the lava plains that formed the valley floor were a ready-made landing strip. Judging from the topographic maps, it should be possible for a team of the astronauts to drive partway up the side of an 11,000-foot mountain called Hadley Delta and hunt for samples. A single piece of primordial crust would justify the mission. The second lure, and the one that gave the valley its name, was a sinuous channel called Hadley Rill, 1 mile wide and 1,300 feet deep. It was one of a dozen such lunar features. Many geologists suspected it had once been a river of a hellish sort, brimming with broiling lava. The first visitors to a lunar rill might be able to solve the mystery. And there were enough other attractions at Hadley, unusual craters, for example, that looked to be volcanic, to make it a geologic bonanza. The scientists were deadlocked. Although the final decision rested with Apollo program director Rocco Petroni, there was an unwritten rule that the choice had to have a thumbs-up from the mission commander. Dave Scott was in the room, and to him the choice was easy, not only for science but for something else he saw as essential, grandeur. It was good for the human spirit, Scott believed, to explore beautiful places. He told the scientists that, although he felt confident he could land at either site, he strongly preferred Hadley. His words tipped the balance. The small valley at the foot of the Apennines became the target for the expedition. For as long as he could remember, the mountains had been a part of Jim Irwin. Long before he knew the grand solitude that belongs to the jet pilot, he had found peace and exhilaration in high country. Some of the happiest times of his childhood had been while exploring the hills around Pittsburgh and the Wasatch Mountains near Salt Lake City. As a young man in Colorado Springs, he learned every hidden trail up Pike's Peak. On vacations, the Irwin family scaled the rounded granite towers of Yosemite and reached the lofty summit of Mount Whitney. Before he soared to even greater heights, Irwin had stood atop many of the major peaks in the country. In the astronaut years, the mountains had been his refuge, when Houston's unbroken flatness and brown water oppressed the eye. When the steamy Gulf air was all but unbreathable, he and his wife, Mary, would escape with the children to the Rockies to hike in the clean, rarefied air. How happy Irwin was, then, to discover that he would fly the first mission to the lunar mountains. Now age 40, Irwin was one of the oldest members of the original 19, and 2 years Scott's senior, and there was a quiet self-confidence about him, a maturity that set him apart. Perhaps almost losing his life and livelihood had reordered Irwin's sense of what mattered. In 1961, he shattered both of his legs in an airplane crash while teaching a student to fly. For a while, the doctors feared he might lose a leg to gangrene. But Irwin fought his way back to flying and built himself into a figure of physical strength. He was probably among the more religious men in the astronaut office, but most of his colleagues would not have known that about him. He was as amiable as any of them, but he did not call any of them close friends. His best friends were his wife and children. For a test pilot, he was decidedly unflamboyant. No lunar module pilot before him had so completely avoided competing with his commander. In his own way, Irwin seemed ideally matched to Scott. Where Scott could be rigid, Irwin was deferential. When he did disagree, it was always with tact. Years later, Scott would say that Jim Irwin was probably the only person who could have gone to the moon with him. Only Irwin could have put up with his authoritarian style of command. In truth, Irwin admired his commander's intelligence and energy. He was sure that if they were to send Dave Scott off to the moon all by himself, that most of the mission would be accomplished. There was no question about it. Apollo 15 was Dave Scott's mission. November 1970, San Gabriel Mountains, California. The rocks were white. They lay in a jumble of slabs and chunks on the floor of a tiny canyon. They had fallen here from much higher up. Scott could see that now. Silver explained that the San Gabriels had pushed up in a spasm of mountain building 20 million years ago. The upheaval had been rapid, in geologic terms, lasting perhaps only a few million years, and even as the rocks were pushed upward, they were fractured by the tremendous stresses of the event. Much more recently, these white rocks had slid off the face of the mountains, whole layers like flecks of peeling paint, into this tiny canyon. According to the geologist's best guess, this chunky white rock, called anorthosite, was the stuff of the moon's primordial crust. One of the unmanned surveyor landers had radioed back data suggesting the existence of this rock in the highlands near the crater Tycho. And tiny pieces of anorthosite had turned up among the coal dark dust from Tranquility Base and the Ocean of Storms. Because of their different composition, it was obvious to the geologists that these misfits had been hurled there from some distant place, namely the highlands, including the Apennine Mountains, that lay beyond the shores of the Maria. One look at the full moon and the contrast between the dark gray Maria and the white highlands spoke to the sense of the idea. Explaining why most of the moon's crust should be composed of anorthosite led some geologists to an extraordinary scenario. Within the infant satellite, they proposed, there was so much heat that the entire outer shell became an ocean of molten rock. As this magma ocean cooled, minerals crystallized. The heavier species, including the iron and magnesium-rich crystals, sank to the bottom. The lighter crystals, specifically the mineral plagioclase, which is the main component of anorthosite, floated to the top. In bringing Scott and Irwin to the San Gabriels, Silver's hope was that if they found anorthosite in the Apennines, they would recognize it from having seen these rocks. It didn't matter how much Scott and Irwin understood about the San Gabriels, or even about the moon's magma ocean, though they seemed to take in just about everything Silver told them. What mattered, on this trip and the others that had become a regular part of the training schedule, was their ability to describe accurately what was in front of them. At first glance, the white blocks seemed to be a random jumble, but the more Scott and Irwin looked, the more they could see order, or organization, as Silver liked to say. Now they could see a band of darker rock running through the fragments, broken but still coherent, like the pattern on a shattered dinner plate. This was the kind of detail that would speak volumes, transmitted across the Earth-Moon airwaves. To Pete Conrad, why talk about the rocks when they'll have the rest of their lives to study them? Silver would have answered with a single word, context. To a field geologist, as much as a sociologist, context is crucial. Rocks, like people, are a lot easier to understand when you know where they came from and who they grew up with. To be sure, when it came to context, the moon didn't make things easy. On the moon, small rocks are hot potatoes. They begin life as high-velocity projectiles, fleeing the blast of a meteorite impact. Once they come to rest, perhaps many miles from their source, they're then likely to be bounced around by later impacts. Over the eons, a cobble-sized specimen might be kicked and nudged hundreds of miles away from the place where it formed. But the bigger a rock is, the harder it is to move. The larger the boulder, the more likely to have formed near the spot where it is found, simply because any jolt strong enough to move it would probably have broken it into pieces. As for an outcrop of true bedrock, that was something no astronaut had yet identified. The promise of outcrops, up on the slopes of the mountains, and perhaps at the rill, was one of Hadley's lures. All the geologists were impressed with how fast the astronauts caught on to the intricacies of lunar field geology. What amazed Silver was that Scott could find time for geology at all. It would one day occur to Lee Silver that the massive effort mobilized for Apollo 15 was like a military invasion. Bob Gilruth, Chris Kraft, Jim McDivitt, and Rocco Petroni were the generals, each with his own theater of operations, and troops of engineers, flight controllers, crew systems specialists, and, of course, contractors around the country, numbering in the tens of thousands. Silver was a captain somewhere in the infantry. There were enough changes and additions to the hardware and the mission design to make Apollo 15 seem almost like a new program. On Long Island, the Grumman people had outfitted Scott's lunar module with improvements, such as bigger fuel tanks, extra batteries, and even a bigger exhaust nozzle for the descent engine to give the LM extra thrust needed to carry the rover and other gear to the surface. At the Boeing Company in Seattle, engineers wrestled with the fledgling lunar roving vehicle. Meanwhile, in Houston, trajectory specialists hammered out the steeper descent path required for Scott's lunar module to come in over the Apennine Mountains. For all of this and more, Dave Scott was the point man. All of these developments competed for his attention. And yet, Scott never turned away the scientists' concerns. He was their advocate with Petroni and the other generals in this invasion. The geologists could hardly believe the resistance that came up whenever they mentioned a new piece of gear. They wanted Scott and Irwin to carry a telephoto lens to take pictures of the mountains and the rill. Petroni and McDivitt fought it. Silver devised a rake to sift small rock samples from the soil. They fought that, too. It was understandable. Every pound in that lunar module was worth precious seconds of hover time. It was a matter of safety. But here again, Scott was the geologist's best ally. He would reach into his shirt pocket and pull out an index card already brimming with action items and add one more. And he'd knit his brow with a kind of mock concern and say to Silver, "We'll work it, Professor." Most of all, Scott made time for the field trips. The training had intensified since the spring. By summer, the trips were no longer merely teaching exercises. In his drive to get ready, Scott pushed Silver to make them more like true simulations, and the men wore backpacks, cameras, and radios. By November, a training version of the rover was added. Everything they did was like an actual mission. They followed traverses designed by the geologists. They used aerial photo maps that had been blurred until they matched the level of detail of the best photos of Hadley. And they solved real geologic problems. The best measure of progress was the increasing sophistication of their geologic descriptions. Up on a hill, Joe Allen, the young scientist astronaut who would serve as CAPCOM for the moonwalks, sat in a tent with a two-way radio. With him were geologists who were unfamiliar with the area, so that they depended on the astronauts' words. Through the end of 1970 and into 1971, Silver and his students were taking a trip every month, sometimes two, and the dynamic that was shaping up was really impressive. The healthy competition that had first showed itself in the Aracopias with the Apollo 13 prime and backup crews was in full flower. Jack Schmidt was very much a part of that chemistry. By his very presence, he raised the level of discussion. On field trips, during the review sessions, Schmidt would notice a key detail that Scott and Irwin had missed. It was easy to see that Dick Gordon was benefiting from having Schmidt as a field partner, and they in turn gave Scott and Irwin something to shoot for. There wasn't any question that each was trying to outdo the other. Field geology is as much an art as a science, altogether different from the rigid, structured world of the simulator. Scott liked the change. He liked the hard work of the field trips, and he liked the camaraderie. Up to now, Scott had not known Jack Schmidt well, but he could honestly say that he had never resented his presence, or any of the scientist astronauts, in the astronaut office. The program needed the diversity they brought, But it was also clear to Scott that letting them fly before the lunar landing had been mastered was out of the question. Now that Schmidt was a key player in Apollo 15, Scott was glad for his help, though he had little patience for Schmidt's jokes, or anything from anyone that felt like a waste of time. And years later, Scott would deny that he was competing with his backup crew. He would say that his motivation was simple. He wanted to please his professor. But that was costing him. More than once on these trips, Silver heard Scott mention how little time he had with his children. His wife, Lurton, had signed up for an introductory geology class at the University of Houston, not only to help fill the time when Dave was away, but so that when he was home, she would have something to talk about. By March, the team had gelled, and people from all levels of NASA were witnessing it. That month, Scott convinced Jerry Griffin, who would be the flight director during the moonwalks, to join a trip to New Mexico's Rio Grande Gorge, so he could understand what Scott and Irwin would try to accomplish on the moon. In April, when they ventured into California's Coso Hills, there must have been 30 or 40 people, including Rocco Petroni and other members of the NASA brass, who had come along to see just what Lee Silver and his students were up to. What they saw was an expeditionary force for a geologic assault on Hadley. On the last day of June 1971, the Space Center was rocked by a reminder that even now there was nothing routine about sending humans into space. Three Soviet cosmonauts were returning to Earth aboard their Soyuz 11 spacecraft after spending 24 days in orbit aboard the Salyut 1 space station, shattering all space endurance records. The flight was nothing less than a milestone toward missions to the planets. Americans would not better the feat for another 2 years. Everything was fine as the Soyuz hurtled toward re-entry under automatic control. Minutes later, recovery helicopters in Kazakhstan spotted the craft descending under an orange and white parachute, but were unable to contact the men by radio. After touchdown, ground crews excitedly hurried to the ship and opened the hatch. To their horror, they found the men dead, still strapped into their seats. Later, they determined that the cosmonauts had perished from a sudden air leak just before re-entry. In Houston, the deaths sent a ripple of concern through the Space Center. With less than a month to go before launch, managers debated changing the flight plan to have Scott's crew don their space suits for re-entry. Scott vetoed the idea. Just because the Soyuz had a problem didn't mean that Apollo was suddenly suspect. His faith in his spacecraft was unshaken. Meanwhile, outside NASA's world, the question that had dogged the moon program for 2 years still lingered. Why send people back to the moon at all? The previous fall, the Soviets had scored two landings with unmanned probes. In September, Luna 16 had brought back a sample of lunar soil. Then, in November, a wheeled robot called Luna Code 1 was dispatched to roam the plains near the moon's Bay of Rainbows, several hundred miles from where Scott and Irwin were slated to land. Gene Shoemaker was now saying it would be better if NASA spent its money on unmanned missions, if they insisted on not sending scientists to the moon. In Scott's mind, the argument was misguided. He and Worden and Irwin would go to the moon with trained eyes and trained minds. No robot could do that. Luna Code couldn't see what they would see, speak the words they would say, feel what they would feel, or come back to tell about it. Hadley was waiting for him and Irwin, and they would meet it with the humans' capacities to probe, to take advantage of the unexpected, to make discoveries. This wasn't about technology. Not anymore. It was the curiosity that now burned inside him, which Lee Silver had helped to ignite, that Apollo was about. In Scott's mind, the first all-up scientific expedition to the moon would be a testament to one of Scott's favorite quotes from Plutarch. "The mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lighted." Chapter 11. To the Mountains of the Moon. Apollo 15. 1. Exploration at its greatest. Of all the dreams that might have visited an 18th-century sea captain, could he have envisioned a spaceship sailing a sunlit void in perfect silence, circling the moon? Could he have imagined its commander, a man who, like him, was skilled in pilotage and navigation, but whose energies were fired by the promise of scientific discovery? No doubt if, by magic, the two men could have stood face to face in the wood-paneled den of some timeless explorer's club, they would have had much to say to one another. For his part, Dave Scott had read up on Captain James Cook, the Englishman whose voyages of discovery preceded Apollo 15 by 2 centuries. In 1768, Cook ventured to the unknown reaches of the South Pacific on the first true scientific expedition aboard the ship he christened Endeavour. After the mercantile journeys of Columbus, Drake, and other pathfinders, Cook followed a new lure, knowledge. Though his attempt to witness a rare transit of Venus early in the journey was foiled by haze, Cook went on to map the unexplored lands of Australia and New Zealand. He returned to England in 1771, exactly 200 years before Apollo 15 left Earth. If the parallels between these explorations were clear to Dave Scott, he was equally aware of the differences. In 2 centuries, the scope of exploration had changed dramatically, and with it the role of the explorer. Cook had played a part in everything from commissioning the boat to finding a crew to charting a course. Getting to the moon required the combined efforts of hundreds of thousands of people for the better part of a decade. Cook and his crew were completely on their own from the time they left port until they returned. The crew of Apollo 15 could talk to mission control almost every step of the way. Scott had no illusions about being a modern-day Cook. There simply were none. But as the command module Endeavour slipped into lunar orbit on July 29, 1971, he could still take inspiration from Cook's words. "I had the ambition to go not only farther than man had gone before, but to go as far as it was possible to go." Friday, July 30, 1971, 5:13 p.m., Houston time. 4 days, 8 hours, 39 minutes mission elapsed time. Riding the invisible flame of its descent engine, the lunar module Falcon, laden with scientific cargo, cleared the crests of the Apennine Mountains and headed for the surface. With less than a minute to go until pitch over, Dave Scott readied himself for the ultimate flying challenge of his career. Just the night before, he had told Jim Irwin, "I'm ready. I'm ready to put that baby in there right now." But now, as Falcon cleared 9,000 feet, Scott looked to his left and saw something that took him by surprise. The bright flank of Hadley Delta Mountain rising above him into the black sky. He had never seen this view in the simulator. For a brief moment, Scott lost the feeling of powered flight and had the unreal sensation of floating slowly past the mountain. Craning to look through the triangular window for a glimpse of the land ahead, Scott saw no sign of Hadley Rill. He was sure they were off target, and moments later, Ed Mitchell in Houston radioed that there was an error in the lander's flight path. They were coming in 3,000 feet to the south. Suddenly, right on schedule, Falcon pitched over, and Scott was confronted by a landscape he did not recognize, craters he had been memorizing for months. Index, Salyut, and a dozen others that were so clear on the lunar orbiter photographs were nowhere to be seen. Instead, he saw a nearly featureless, sun-drenched plain. But now, in the distance, he could see Hadley Rill, as distinct as a trowel's cut through wet clay. There wasn't time to go hunting for any other landmarks. Scott used the canyon as his marker and aimed a good distance short of it. He steered to the right, taking out the error in the automatic guidance, and brought Falcon in on instinct. Lower now, he could begin to see features he recognized, and at last a good landing area. In his earphones, he heard the calm voice of his lunar module pilot with a steady stream of altitude readings and LPD angles. 1,000 feet, 4-5, 900, 4-5. Scott gave himself a silent reminder, bring it on down. He'd studied the landings of those who went before him, and he knew that for some reason, perhaps out of an unwillingness to really trust their own landing radar data, and undoubtedly because it was so hard to judge one's altitude above a moonscape by eye, Conrad and Shepard had unwittingly descended along a stair-step pattern that used up fuel. Scott wanted to avoid that. At 150 feet, he began his final vertical descent. Immediately, he saw streaks of dust blow across the pockmarked ground. At 60 feet, a dust storm raged beneath him, completely obscuring the surface. He turned his gaze away from the window and continued on instruments, just as he had done many times in the simulator. He slowed Falcon to a near hover, and as Irwin read off the diminishing altitude, Scott waited for the contact light, mindful of Falcon's bigger exhaust nozzle, which increased the necessity to shut down the engine at the moment of touchdown. When Scott saw the blue glow of the contact light, his hand went immediately to the engine stop button. Several thousand pounds heavier than previous landers, Falcon fell to the moon with a firm thud that rattled every piece of gear in the cabin and brought an exclamation of surprise from Irwin. "Man!" The ship pitched backward slightly and tipped to one side. Then there was stillness. "Okay, Houston," Scott announced. "The Falcon is on the plane at Hadley." As the dust settled, the men saw that they had come down in the right place. Straight ahead stood Bennett Peak, christened for trajectory expert Floyd Bennett, who helped devise the landing profile that brought them safely over the mountains. Somewhere, much nearer, was Hadley Rill, but it was hidden by the hummocky terrain. From now on, Scott told Irwin, they would call this place Hadley Base. Scott and Irwin would not go outside now. They would take their first moonwalk tomorrow after a good night's rest. That was unlike any mission before theirs, but Scott had realized from the first that with 67 hours on the surface, he and Irwin could not do business the way previous crews had. There was an important difference between staying on the moon and living there. To perform at their best, they would need to maintain their normal day-night cycle, and so, the previous autumn, Scott pushed to change the flight plan. Not only was the new schedule in tune with his and Irwin's circadian rhythms, it opened up some time for something Scott really wanted, a reconnaissance. Lee Silver had taught him, when you arrive at a new field site, go to a high place and look around. Scott was ready to do just that, and the high place was the lunar module's top hatch. 7:22 p.m. As the last wisps of oxygen left Falcon's cabin, Irwin stood by while Scott opened the top hatch, climbed onto the ascent engine cover, and stood up, so that his helmeted head and shoulders stuck up above the LM's gleaming metal structure. From this high vantage, Scott beheld a scene that was at once alien and uncannily familiar. All around him, beyond the undulating mare, stood the rounded peaks of the Apennines. Nothing, not months of study, not even the view from orbit, had prepared him for the majesty of the lunar mountains. Their smooth, bright forms were arrayed in fluid sculpture under the black sky. Their slopes were virginal, marred by only an occasional small crater. For eons they had stood unchanged. Now, gazing on their ancient beauty, Scott was all but overwhelmed. Immediately he spotted familiar features. To the northeast, a slender crescent of sunlight delineated the ridge crest of Mount Hadley. Almost 3 miles high, the bulk of the great mountain still cloaked in shadow. Due east, beneath the sun's obliterating glare, stood the hills he and Irwin had christened the Swan Range. Looking southeast, Scott spotted the lone rocky pinnacle they had named for their professor, Silver Spur. None of these places were accessible to him and Irwin, but to the south lay their destination for the first two moonwalks, Hadley Delta Mountain. Over 11,000 feet high, Hadley Delta would have held its own among the Rockies. Here it towered imposingly above the mare, its steep sides topped by a wide, flat crest. Before the mission, some of the geologists had warned that Hadley Delta's flank might be littered with boulders. No one could predict whether he and Irwin would be able to drive there. Now, thankfully, Scott couldn't see any boulders at all. Tomorrow, he and Irwin would drive onto the western slope to St. George Crater, a gouge the size of 27 football fields in the mountainside. Farther along the flank to the east was a much smaller pockmark named Spur, one of the prime targets for the second traverse on Sunday. Monday's plans included Hadley Rill, and while the canyon was still out of view, Scott could see another destination for the final moonwalk, an intriguing collection of craters called the North Complex. Scott would have been amazed to find so many spectacular features in one place on Earth, let alone another world. Scott aimed a telephoto lens at Silver Spur, the North Complex, and a handful of other lures. He rattled off descriptions, speaking not only to Joe Allen in Mission Control, but to Lee Silver, Gordon Swan, and the rest of the scientists in the geology back room. Then, half an hour after emerging into the sunlight, Scott withdrew into the safety of his lunar module, sure that he and Irwin would not find this place wanting. 10:32 p.m. Jim Irwin let his remarkably light body settle into his beta-cloth hammock. He was grateful to be in 1/6 G, glad to be free from the mild but persistent disorientation he'd felt in weightlessness during the trip out to the moon. He could not have wished for a more comfortable bed. His 25-pound form barely sank into the cloth strip. For the first time, no bulky spacesuit would compromise an astronaut's sleep on the moon. The newly designed suits not only offered more mobility to aid the work on the surface, but were easier to put on and take off, affording him and Scott the luxury of stripping down to their long johns and placing the suits, like stowaways, in the back of the tiny cabin. Before the flight, they'd trained to sleep by spending a night in the simulator, with tapes of the LM's coolant pumps and machinery playing in the background. Now, just in case, they wore earplugs. Neither man talked as he lay in the darkened cabin, knowing it was important to fall asleep as quickly as possible. For just a few minutes, Irwin was alone with his thoughts. He felt lucky to be here. Not too long ago, he had doubted this day would come. Less than a year ago, he had been so troubled that he had considered resigning from the crew. The grind of training had stressed his marriage almost to the breaking point. His family life had been turned into a series of long separations interrupted by weekends at home that were spoiled by arguments and cold silences. He wanted to focus his entire being on the mission, but his troubles at home distracted him. It was different for Scott. He and Lurton had an Air Force marriage, and she understood the priorities. She'd been through the training grind with Dave 4 times before this, counting his stints on backup crews, and by now the family was used to his long absences. But Mary Irwin had never been exposed to military life before she met her husband. As an astronaut's wife, she distrusted the fame that went along with the job. She kept her distance from the other wives, foregoing the afternoon get-togethers and the social events of the Astronaut Wives Club. But unlike her husband, Mary Irwin was no loner, and she sought support at a neighborhood church. She and Jim belonged to different Christian sects, and their religious differences were driving yet another wedge between them. By Christmas, with the mission less than 8 months away, Mary was on the brink of divorcing him. More than once, Irwin had considered going to Deke Slayton and asking to be taken off the crew, but each time he'd thought better of the idea. Instead, he took the problem to his commander. He could not have known that his crewmate, Al Worden, had done the same thing when he faced the breakup of his own marriage in 1969. "Do what you need to do," Scott had told Worden, promising to talk to Slayton on his behalf. And in fact, Worden stayed on the crew after his divorce. But when Irwin went to Dave Scott, his advice was to wait it out. "Everybody goes through it," Scott said. "It'll change." And it did change. The problems at home began to ease in the last few months before the flight. Relieved, Irwin was free to devote his entire energies to getting ready. Meanwhile, as launch day approached, it was Scott who seemed to grow more irritable, more tight, under the pressure of command. Last Monday morning, as Irwin lay inside Endeavour and felt the Saturn V rise from the Earth, he experienced a feeling of release so strong that he almost shed tears. No one could call him back now. Minutes later, when Endeavour reached orbit, Irwin was amazed to look out and see the crescent moon perfectly framed in his window. He was sure it was a good omen. Now, before he closed his eyes, Irwin did